to everybody. We'll be starting class shortly. Jill will be continuing with the fourth class on Koheles. And we'll just start momentarily. We'll be continuing from chapter 1, and we'll conclude the chapter today. And that's chapter 1, verses 16, 17, and 18. And we just do a brief audio check. Make sure that you're picking up the audio stream properly. So once you hear the audio, just type audio OK at the bottom of your screen. And JHS, thanks a lot for the confirmation. And again, we'll start just momentarily, probably about just a minute or two of a friend's call in, and then we'll start the class. Website and listen to the previous classes. Good morning, Doug. Good morning, Cal.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Good.
Josh, you still there?
Yeah.
Hey, Josh, how are you? I can hear you a lot better today.
Oh, good.
Yeah, good. Okay, so we're going to continue with Koheles, where we left off. That is chapter 1, verse 16. Last time we left off, where he was examining the actions of man, and that very nice statement of Ibn Ezra, how he referred to it as being a vexating spirit, a really bothersome, difficult type of an activity. Ibn Ezra said, because man is not able to grab onto it with his hands. And we explain that that means that when man does activities, he has a projected or anticipated perception as to what this will offer him. He fabricates certain satisfactions in his mind that justify going after various activities, be they laborious or be they simple. But things that please man, that he goes after these things, we gave an example like getting honored at a dinner or getting a promotion at work or so on and so forth. So he always projects onto the moment some sort of a grandiose type of euphoria. Unfortunately, it doesn't last, you know, or it doesn't meet the expectations, because fantasy is always a tremendous buildup over what reality can really provide. So that's why he says that you really can't seize onto it with your hand, because it's really in the mind. And reality is not going to satisfy what the fantasy fabricates. So, but this is talking about the area of action, activities. You see, King Solomon had explored, you know, the whole panorama of human earthly existence. And you know, one part of existence is actions, goals that man sets up, and then the attitudes, what's going on in his mind. Most people don't reflect, so they are not even aware of this. But when they hear King Solomon talk about it, it rings a bell, it rings true. Now he moves away from actions, and again, you have to be sensitive to the clues that he's giving in the verses. Again, this is, you're talking about a person that was given knowledge overnight by God. So now he continues, and now let's see what he's exploring. So he says in chapter 1, verse 16, he says, I spoke in my heart, I spoke with my heart, saying, behold, I have become great, and I have increased wisdom over all those that were before me in Jerusalem, and my heart has seen much wisdom and knowledge. And I give now 17. Therefore, he says, I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know holelus. Holelus, he says, is like a mixture, no real control over the mind. And then he said the third area that he gave over himself to look at is called sichlus, and that means foolishness, just completely undirected type of a lifestyle, just doing whatever he feels, going by the seat of the pants, I guess you can say. But he says about this, Yadati, I know, Shagam Zehu Ryan Ruh, I know that this is also a vexation of spirit, this is also a bothersome pursuit. And 18, he starts off with the word because, so we know that that is now an explanation. He says, because with much wisdom there is much anger, and when one increases his knowledge, he increases his pain. Okay. So we see the first thing we take note of is the contrast to an examination of human activity, which was the previous couple of verses. Now he says, I spoke with my heart. So now, how is that different than examining pursuits? And you see, he continues. In 17, he also says, so in the beginning of 16, I spoke with my heart. And then in 17, it says, and I gave over my heart to know and to examine wisdom and to know foolishness and to know stupidity. Meaning he's examining different states of the mind. So it makes sense why he's not looking at actions. He's not examining the world of the practical right now. He examined that already. He showed a certain flaw there. In the world of the practical, the human being throws up many ego emotions that cannot be satisfied. And he never gets to really to fulfill what he anticipated. Now he says he's doing something in his mind alone. Dibarti im libi. I spoke with my heart. And it's important also to take note, Ibn Ezra makes a comment, he says, because the heart is the seat of the spirit, And that was created in the person first. It is sort of like a form of a king. And the brain is the head office, or the general of war. So the mind, the person's heart, is really what's there first. And the brain really carries out the orders. So he understood that, the brain is really not the soul. But you see that he's making a statement, perhaps, because a person could say that if he's now examining the self, so that may be a problem, because the thing which is doing the examining may be corrupt. But it seems to be that he's saying no. He's trying to first let you know that when I do a self-examination, I'm both the observer and I'm also the subject. But he says it's okay, because he says, I have increased knowledge over all those before me. And he was able to actually separate himself. In 17 he says, and I gave my heart to know wisdom. So that means he was able to separate the me, right? In the beginning of 16 he says, I spoke with my heart. That means to say that he was able to separate himself from whatever the heart was perceiving. He was able to give an objective analysis, which only he can do. So he was able to do that. You see later on that that's true, because he says, one second. In 2:3, chapter 2, verse 3, he says, I did both. I taught the belief in the Shach behind. I sort of did a split type of approach where I joined both drinking wine, and to my heart, though, however, I kept accustomed to wisdom. Okay. But it says in the end of 2:9, after he created all his palaces and his brooks and his trees and his servants and gold and kesef and the gold and silver that he acquired, he says, and I increased. And then 2:9 he says, I increased and I added on more than all those before me in Jerusalem. But look what he says, but my wisdom stood with me. So you see that his wisdom was able to be separate. He was able to be an objective observer as to what he was doing. Okay, so you see that's the first thing. He says that what I'm now going to venture to do is a self-examination, but the observer will be separate from the subject. All right, so far so good?
Yep, thank you.
Okay. So then he says that I now became the one that had the greatest wisdom of all those before me. So now what does he do? He looks at three different areas in 17. He says, I gave my heart to know wisdom, to know foolishness, and to know stupidity. Meaning, which area of involvement of the mind is going to be satisfied? Let's be objective. Let's look and see where is going to be the greatest satisfaction. So he says, now let's just see if we can define the difference between the three. Right. So Chachma means he's leading a path of knowledge, strictly by wisdom. And then to look at Halelus is the second one. And again, we'll stick with Rashi's definition. That means, he says, a distraught type of mind, really no direction. And he says it's a language of confusion. So will this lead to any type of, if I do not have a strict direction of intelligence over the mind and I just let it go where it may, will that freedom supply me with any satisfaction?
Rabbi?
Yes.
So are those the three? We've got wisdom, we got the distraught type of mind with no real direction, and then the third is the language of confusion?
The third one, it seems to be, according to Rashi, he says shtus, which means like foolishness, stupidity.
So the language of confusion part goes with the second one.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, that's again according to Rashi. Okay. But you see, and when he gives the reasoning why neither one worked, look in 18, he says at the end of 17, but I know that this is an evil spirit, meaning it's something which is a wrong way to go. But he doesn't have to explain the second and third. He only explains why wisdom didn't satisfy him. Evidently, it's self-evident that, he's showing all the paths, but certain paths are self-evident why it's not going to lead anywhere. Of course, if a person is foolish and he's just goes by the seat of his pants, or certainly if he just follows stupidity, he's not complying with the natural operation of the world. So he has to meet with dissatisfaction, because he's locking horns with the way the world operates. So a person cannot expect to be trying to make a living to do things that are contrary to that. He has to be in line with that, so just from a practical standpoint. But he says even with wisdom there was a problem. And what does he say the problem was? That's 18. He says, because with the increase of wisdom there is anger, much anger, and with the increase of knowledge there is great pain, there's suffering. Now what is this example of this? Ibn Ezra explains. And he says on 18, the explanation why following after wisdom led to pain. He says, because as one seeks out to know, have understanding, so he says, he saw that the one who has understanding recognizes the matters of the world with the great amount of knowledge that he has. And he was going to always be in anger and in pain. And he would not be happy, for example, with his son, because he knows that his end will be death, either during his life or after his life. And he won't be happy with his riches, because it's ka'of yofif, it's like it'll be squandered quickly. And also, he knows it will not help him on the day of his calamity. Money cannot help a person sometimes if he's sick or if some events take place. So money is not always able to save a person. And he says, finally, and the day of death is placed between man's eyes. So what is he saying is the problem with having much knowledge, specifically?
All it does is make you see reality more clearly, which isn't very satisfying.
What part of reality?
The fact that all the material stuff around you is basically, in one sense, useless, and it's going to disappear, and so are you in the end.
Okay. Your last word is the key.
The in the end part.
Right, exactly. Meaning what he is now showing you here is that if a person really rips through all the veils of a typical human being, he's going to eventuate in seeing with his great wisdom. He has, like a King Solomon, great wisdom. So, Pirkei Avos, Ethics for the Father, says, who is a wise man? He's the one who knows the outcome of his actions. And that's exactly what Solomon was showing here, is that with such an amount of knowledge, every single thing that happens, if the knowledge is always at work, and it's never at bay, so then the person is now looking, okay, what will this do at the end? What will this do at the end? And that's what the Ibn Ezra said in every one of the four cases. He says that why will it be that with knowledge he'll have pain and suffering and anger? Because when he looks at his son who he's proud of, he knows that eventually he'll die, either in his life or after his life. And he knows that money is something which is fleeting. It can be fly away. And it also won't help him when he has a calamity in the future. So he's looking at future events also. The future of his son, the future of his money, the future of calamities that eventually take place in life. And then the ultimate future is death. So you see, Ibn Ezra is giving you four examples to drive the point home that where is the real vexation of spirit that King Solomon is talking about? Is that if a person cannot deny all the knowledge that he has, I mean, the King Solomon, he's going to say what happens next. A person which tells you how come the typical person is happy then? And why was King Solomon not happy? What does this teach you, a very important lesson about a typical person? Where does a typical person's happiness come from?
Probably what's either what's just happening or what's about to happen in the very near term, but not the long term.
Right. We can basically say that a person who is, like there's a saying, ignorance is bliss. What that means is that a person, typically to get happiness, has to close off his mind to any future event or repercussions. That's why a person has a fantasy about an event or a certain new automobile that he's to buy. Whatever it is, it's an image which is pristine and it is unmarred and it also is unending. It has to be perfect from every angle. Perfect in terms of the substance, perfect in terms of the duration, perfect in terms of the satisfaction. But that means that he's now shutting off his mind to any reality, what will happen in the end, what will happen in the future. King Solomon was saying that you cannot have real happiness if there is no denial of some element. And he says next, which follows through on this point, in 2:1, he says, and we also should understand, why is it that it's anger and pain in the end of 18? So, I mean, 18 says that with the increase in wisdom, there's much anger. Anger is typically an attempt to change reality. That's what anger is. That's what the rabbis say, that one who's angry is akin to serving idols. Because just like one who serves idols, it is completely distorting the reality. That's the worst distortion of reality. The truest idea in reality is that it is an existence exclusively created by God. An idolater is just the opposite. He says existence is not created by God, and there's something else that can manipulate existence. I can pray to an idol and it will change my state of affairs. So that's why anger is akin to that. But anger is also, in and of itself, a desire to alter what is happening right now. It's a dissatisfaction, the inability to accept what's in front of one person. And pain is anguish where a person gives up, where he's pained and he's grieved and he feels as he's not really trying to change it. Anger is really a response to a frustrated attempt at trying to have a certain reality and it doesn't happen. But there's another type of reaction when something is not going your way. There's when a person relinquishes, he's in pain. So that's why there's two types of responses when things don't happen the way a person wants. It depends on the person. But then he says further in 2:1, he said, I said in my heart, let me come now, and I will imbibe myself with a pour. Anasna means like pour wine. He says, with happiness, Ure'e Beethoven, I will see what good there is. But he says, this is also heaven. So he says, now let me try something else. Since the intellectual sphere didn't satisfy him, of course, Holelus and Sichlus, the last two in 17, were really futile because it just locked horns with reality. They really couldn't, they can't be any good. I mean, he says later on that wisdom is far superior than ignorance. But he does at least, he notes the different possibilities. Either a person can live a life of wisdom, or he can go to the other extreme and just completely ignore wisdom, or he can go by the seat of his pants and just follow whatever emotions guide him at that moment.
Rabbi, in 17 there?
Yeah.
The translation I'm looking at says, to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. It seems like these group, is that how it reads? It's not to know wisdom and to know madness and to know folly. See what I'm saying?
Like, right, it could be two. Like, it could be two, you're right.
What's that?
It could be that it's only two, either wisdom on the one hand, or grouping man that doesn't follow his one. I'm reading Rashi. Rashi gives three.
Yeah. I mean, it could still be three, but he's just kind of, it seems like he'd be categorizing the last two together and then wisdom on some.
Yeah, there's different views on what that actually is.
Okay.
Let's see.
Because it doesn't say to know in front of the last one, right?
No, it does. It does say that.
It does.
He says, I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know Holelus and Sichlus. Meaning to examine, to explore in his mind what is the benefits of either. And he says, merely from that standpoint, intellectually, so there's a problem with them all. But he really only had to explain the problem with the first one, because it's understood that the last two are really going to completely be a dissatisfaction to man. But they are possibilities, so he names them. But he only has to tell you the repercussions of wisdom, because that's the real insight that he's offering. The other ones are, it's obvious that they will lead a person to pain. Go ahead.
Yeah, he only says to know twice, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
But you see also what he does is, you know, we're talking about to know the latter end. I just want to keep our focus here that the reason why he was dissatisfied with wisdom is because when you know a lot, so then again you don't have the ignorance is bliss. And now he gives a beautiful explanation over here. He says he's going to try something else now. He's going to try drinking and being involved in what's simcha, what happiness, glad, being glad, and to see if there's a good here. But he said this is futile. Now he explains, that was 2.1. Now 2.2 is the explanation. Look at this verse. He says in 2.2, he says, laughter, to joking around. I said, this is a mixture. It's mehula. He uses the same word as before as being a confusion, some sort of a confusion when a person is joking around. So of course, what it was to mean, that's a confusion. Meaning and to simcha, to rejoicing, he says, what does this do? All right, now think about this verse for a minute. Think about the verse. There's two things he's telling you over here. He left off thinking about the intellectual path, and I was saying, well, let me try drinking. All right, and that's based on Rashi. Okay, let me get involved in that type of life where I lighten the heart. And what happens when I do that? He says there's two things. There's the joking around part, but he says that's a confusion. He ridicules that as being a confusion. What do you mean a confusion? And to rejoicing, he says, what does it do? So now what you have to do is define both. What is joking around laughter, and why is his ridicule of that? He rejects that because that's some sort of a confusion. What's the confusion? All right. And the second thing that happens when a person's lighthearted and he's drinking, so he gets into like a rejoicing type of a mood. But then, again, his mind stayed clear while he was doing this. And he says, no, the problem here is, what does it do? So let's see if we can define why there's two parts of the drinking, and also what the rejection is for both. If there's any questions for clarification, you know, let me know.
Rabbi, we're talking about 2.2.
That's right.
2.1 and 2?
Chapter 2 verses, chapter 2 verses 1 and 2, correct. But primarily, verse 2.
Okay. Well, is he saying the same thing that and I guess I'm particularly pointing at the second one concerning rejoicing, what does this accomplish? He's kind of looking at the far consequence, like, okay, in the end it doesn't mean anything.
Good. Right, so in terms of the latter part of verse 2, he says, he says, what does this do? So what is being... What part of the human being is not satisfied there? When a person says, what does this do for me? What is he saying?
it doesn't do anything for his essence?
Better, you could say better than that.
Well, there's no benefit for his soul.
Well, I think he was trying to just find the Tov, right? He says, I'm going to drink wine and get involved in like a happy-go-lucky type of a state, or a glad or a fun type of a state of mind, and I will see the Tov, and I will try to reach the good with this. I will see if this will allow to register on me as this is really the good. Again, the search here is what is really something which registers with me as really being the good. I mean, there's a value system also at work here, you have to realize. So he's not looking
for... You say with his intelligence?
What's that?
You say like with his intelligence? Is that like part of him that registers happiness?
It's true. I mean, that the intelligence is there. He tried that in the previous verses, but now he's trying, and he saw that intelligence just led him to pain because he always saw with his intelligence, the more he thought about something, the more he saw through how that's just a facade. And we said earlier that a person, the saying about ignorance is bliss, that a person has to have a certain ability to live in the moment if he's going to be happy with the typical things that make a person happy in life. But King Solomon here is being brutally honest, and he's saying, let's look at what people are happy with. Let's try the drinking. That's what he's doing right now. So I'm going to drink. Now, what does drinking do? It gets me involved in two areas of laughter and joking around, like, and then also rejoicing. The thing I think we should really do is define what's the difference between joking around and rejoicing.
Well, it would seem like rejoicing is when you are truthfully expressing gratitude for something.
I don't think you have to express anything to rejoice. Isn't rejoicing an internal sentiment?
Yeah, but you're usually rejoicing over something.
Let's say this Thursday, a lot of us will be having a turkey at Thanksgiving, friends are coming over, people we haven't seen in a while, so they'll be rejoicing. What is rejoicing and what is joking?
Well, one could say that joking is to make light of something in some way that is such a surprise that it's unexpected and therefore evokes laughter.
Okay. How is that different from rejoicing?
Joking seems to be just a phenomenon of the moment.
Very good. Excellent.
Whereas rejoicing, you could rejoice over the fact that, you know, I was able to get up this morning and get out of bed and, you know, eat breakfast, and lots of people on the planet don't get that opportunity.
Right, I would agree. A joke is a momentary thing, whereas rejoicing is more of an estimation of a person's status. He looks at himself and he rejoices. He's part of what's going on right now in his mind, and he rejoices that this gives him some satisfaction. So there really is no expression. There's just, he's now reflecting and likes where he fits in with what is going on in reality. There's an estimation of what is a good thing in life, and he sees himself in this state. It's not a split second, it's a state. A person rejoices at a wedding, at an event, something that has a duration. Now, once we see the difference between laughter, or joking around on the one hand, and rejoicing, now let's look at his critique of both. So what's the critique of laughter, of a momentary thing? He says, there's a confusion in it. And what does Rashi say? I'll read it to you word for word. It's three words. He says, there is a mixture of crying and anguish. So that's the critique of a joke.
Wait, can you repeat? Rashi says it's a mixture of what?
of crying and anguish. Meaning any joke, he says, is a mixture of crying and anguish. Meaning those are mixed with the joke. There's the joke, there's the attempt at humor, and then there's the crying and the anguish. And I see we're getting a demonstration of what crying is from one of our friends there. But tell him to articulate his point better, Nomi.
I guess I would disagree with Rashi on that point.
Yeah, what do you mean?
Well, I'm thinking of some jokes or humorous moments that I've seen, and I can't see that there's a particular element of crying or anguish in it.
All right. So why do you think Rashi does say that? I found that it's always a very good tool when, you know, sometimes I'm talking to people and they, you know, really vehemently disagree with a certain point. So what I try to do is I found this effective. Is I say, well, if they're like disagreeing with something, and let's say Maimonides or Freud or Einstein, if somebody said something opposite to that, you know, a great mind. So I don't get them to try to change their position, but I try to ask them, well, why do you think, you know, these minds did say the opposite of what you're saying? Forget about agreeing with them or not, but can you at least explain where they're coming from? So then you're not opposing the person, and he's not put into a neutral state where he feels safe to give an explanation. Because up to that point, most people are always defending themselves. They feel when they speak, I'm now putting myself on the line, and I can't back off, I can't retreat, because that's a blow to the ego. But if you say, listen, I'm not asking about you right now, I'm asking what would your assessment be of these other people who had a different opinion. So now it's a safe way to put them in a state of mind where they can explore. They're not now asked to defend their position, but they're just asked to give an opposite view of what they think another person might think. And what that does is it allows them to consider that opposite view. So it's tangential. I'm mentioning this, but I just found it very effective very, very recently. I saw this as a very helpful tool. So I'm going to put it to you. So you're saying you disagree with Rashi, but let me ask you, where do you think Rashi is coming from?
So I can think of at least some situations where it could be that the psyche of a person is somewhat desperate. They feel a huge amount of stress or pressure or tension, and that the making of a joke is a way to cover that, and the laughter is actually a cover for the fact that they don't want to face up to their, in using his words, their internal crying and anguish.
Right, meaning, agreed. That's what I think Ryan is saying, because why is a person promoted to drink and to take drugs and to do these type of things and to joke around? Many times it is because he's trying to be happy because he's not. That's what it could be. He's a very simple thing. A person attempts certain quick jabs at getting a momentary laugh because he needs it. You know, to say it as simple as possible. So, and it's not, you know, and in your position as well, I see. You get together with friends and you're joking around, so it's a good state, you're enjoying you want to make them, you want to make them happy. So I would agree with you, it's not all the time. But it's good what you pointed out too, is that that's a momentary type of a thing. That's one area of trying to seek, you know, happiness in the moment. But he says the problem with that is that many times it's mixed up with anguish and crying. So it's really not pure, he wants to say. That's his first critique. The joke and the laughter is really not pure.
Rabbi?
Yes?
It seems, too, that oftentimes joking is at the expense of something or someone else, and that is sort of a false way of raising yourself up.
Yes, it's sort of like Lashon Hara to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah, there's something bothering the person, and he has to go ahead and cloak it and to change it around. He doesn't want to see himself in a bad state. So that's one thing. That's the momentary. All right. What does he say about simcha, rejoicing? His critique of that is, what does this do? Now, where does that response come from? What part of the person does that come from?
Maybe it doesn't. It makes you happy, but doesn't get rid of your unhappiness, perhaps?
Well, when a person says, what does this do, what part of his personality is saying that? What failed? See, again, a person who can live in the moment and live in denial will have a certain satisfaction. But that means his mind is put on hold. And he's like thinking right now, this is the good, the drinks with a friend, having a smoke, joking around, going outside, sitting by the pool, talking about old times. The reason why they can have that satisfaction is because they look at this as being the be-all and end-all, and they're locked in that moment. And King Solomon is saying that that's fine if you want to live in a denial. But he said, with me, something was, there was, reality was always in front of my eyes. Like he said before, I could be very happy with my son, but one day he'll die. It could be in my life, could be afterwards. Or the riches that I have, I've got to worry about it. The Pirkei Avos also says, a person has many possessions, he is much more anguished than another person, because now he's worrying about preserving his possessions. Right, you see, today's stock economy is a very good example. A person who's got no money is really not fazed at all by the shifts in the market today. A person who's got a lot of money, they're the ones that are really hurting the most. I read recently about some billionaire who lost 90% of his fortune. Now he's saying, but what about gladness? Gladness is not the momentary joking. It's where a person's trying to seize a certain duration of time. But what does he say? What is the meaning when he says, what does this do for me? It means a sense of accomplishment that is never stopped in King Solomon's mind. There's always, remember, we talked about in the beginning certain primary attitudes and needs that a person chases after. He wants to feel that he's living in the moment. The feeling of modernity, as Rabbi Chait explained, that we've got it. Our generation is really past everybody else. But a person says that because of ego, but there must be a threat. What's the threat? We said there's a very subtle sensation that we realize that we're only here due to the previous generation. So it is a certain type of a competition going on. I don't want to look at the old generations that are gone and that's it and they expired. Why? They died out. Now that awakens a threat. My own mortality is now put between my eyes. So then I respond, no, we're better. We've got technology. We've got advances. We're better. As if that's going to save the person from dying. No, it doesn't. And it's trying to inflate the ego too. But you see that the threat comes from a previous generation because he realizes the previous generation are no different than him. He came from them, so he's really owes something to them. And also, they perished, and I sense that threat too. And we also said there's the feeling of that accomplishment. Right? That was one of the first things Rabbi Chait explained, that he says in chapter 1, verse 3, what benefit is there to man and all his work that he does? Meaning, yes, there means an additional thing. What more is there to me? What is this additional, besides the work that I have to plow and seed and reap and then eat? So that's a necessity, of course. But the person's looking for something additional. People have different things in their mind that they're looking for. So he puts his finger on, he really has his finger on the pulse of a lot of primary unspoken needs and concerns that a human being has. And one of them is a sense of accomplishment. So that's what he says over here. As I said earlier, he says, just like before, what does it do? What extra is there? What do I accomplish? So here also he says that it also, that problem, that need for accomplishment, undermines any satisfaction I have in rejoicing in something. Because after it's all over and, you know, said and done with, where does that leave me? And Rashi says the same thing. Right? He says, he says, the end is not really going to do anything for me. Right? After it's all over, then what? So, again, King Solomon had all this before his eyes. Of course, the question will be, how do we live based on, should we follow what King Solomon is doing? Is that the right thing? And he was brutally honest. I mean, we cannot deny the realities that he saw. But you see, you do have, like, for example, you know, the command of Simchas Yontif, of gladdening yourself in the holiday, and you should have meat and you should have wine. So it appears that the person living the Torah life is commanded to live in the moment, and your typical person cannot be this brutally honest and just at any time he's about to enjoy something, he says, well, yeah, this is a nice glass of wine, but it's going to be empty soon. Or this is a nice affair, you know, my best friend's son's getting married, it's going to be over tomorrow morning, and then what? That's not how the regular person functions. It does not appear to me that that is what the Torah really wants. But here, what King Solomon is doing, he's brutally honest, and the Torah also does not want to cloak over any reality. And if somebody wanted to say something.
Yeah, Rabbi, I was going to bring up that weren't the Jewish people punished because they did not serve their God with joy?
Right. Right, that has to be there. And when, like I was saying, the holidays command the person to have meat and wine. So that means that that's a limited span of time, a holiday.
But I got the impression that the way that phrase was used is it's almost like an underlying state.
Yeah, a person
can only be in a state of joy.
Right. We'll have to see as the book unfolds what he does. What, again, we're still right at the beginning over here. So I'd love to jump to the ending too, and I may just do that. it's important to see his development of these different issues and how he's showing, he's really unveiling the different things that are work, different intellectual devices, I guess we can call them, or psychological devices that are always at work. I mean, if a person thought that he's going to make money and lose it, would he get up and work in the morning? You see, I believe it's Mishlei, it's not here, that he says, King Solomon says, that God has placed the world between man's eyes, meaning he's given man a certain denial of death, because without it a person would be morbid, he would not be able to move. So a person has to feel a certain permanence, he has to feel he's going to have a certain duration in this world, otherwise he won't build houses, he won't get married, he won't have the zest to get together with friends and to accomplish things in life. Maybe we'll have to try to see and define what really it was, the outlook that King Solomon had at the end. But right now he's exploring. He's being, and the Torah does not want to hide anything, which is true. Okay, any questions or comments?
I think we're good here.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, but it's a nice verse. You see how that one verse, chapter 2, verse 2, he talks about laughter and rejoicing, and in each one, it has its own specific corresponding, ridicule as to what the problem is with it. evidently, in the rejoicing, the reason why accomplishment was the issue, and not something else, is because it was combating it. Something about the rejoicing in a person's mind. Why was the sense of accomplishment the real problem with it? Why not some other issue? So I think that's the answer. The answer, if you see what his ridicule is, it gives you an insight into what the person was really looking for with the rejoicing. See, accomplishment is something that's a duration. Something is left over. There is something new achieved. But that's the problem with the rejoicing. Rejoicing has a duration, but it doesn't leave its mark for a long time.
Rabbi?
Yes?
Accomplishment seems to feed the ego, too, like I did this.
Right, I agree. Right. So I was saying more.
Rejoicing seems to imply more gratitude.
Right. It's a good point you're raising, that what's the primary element in accomplishment? Is it the I did it, or that something was achieved? It got me to a new state in life. Something was accomplished. I sense that it's more of the latter. It's not so much the I, but that I'm in the new, there's something new now. I've moved on. I've progressed. A person staying stagnant is something which is dissatisfying, because a person inherently we're born with this need for accomplishment. Let's do more. Let's it's not something you have to learn. It's an interesting thing. There are certain things in the human psyche that you do not have to learn. Like possessiveness. You see a little child, it says mine, you know, it's one of the first words he knows. Hey, that's my toy. This possession, me. This competition. That's not learned. That's innate. The ability to compare and to discern. The child knows right away that a certain face is not common, and he's scared. It's a stranger. Because the mind is always comparing what it's looking at. That's how it identifies things. It instantaneously refers to its memory of everything that it's seen or heard, and it labels it instantly as well. Is this familiar? Is this not familiar? So, same thing with accomplishment. That's something which appears to be something that's not learned, although people do have it in different degrees. Some children also are not so concerned with a strange face, and some are. So there are different degrees. We all have the same exact psychological faculties, just like every human being has two arms, two legs, and so on. So everybody has feelings of resentment, revenge, hate, love, insecurity, accomplishment, the ability to compare things automatically. So there are different degrees in people. But you see here that's really what the problem with rejoicing is. Rejoicing, a person wants to say, in other words, this is now a new state of life. The only problem is that a person who's brutally honest will understand that, like many other affairs he went to, this one will also be over soon, too. And then a week, a month down the road, it will have no effect whatsoever. It'll be as if it never happened.
So, Rabbi, in a lot of popular success literature, and even in some that is written from and by, I think, Torah-focused people, there's the idea that, well, the way to success is you set goals, and then you achieve those goals, and then when you get those goals done, you set a new set of goals, and so you're always setting, you know, greater and greater goals for yourself.
Okay.
And you, on the one hand, you could say, yep, that's the way you achieve success. And on the other hand, you could say, that's just an endless treadmill of effort that never leads to, you know, complete satisfaction, because you never get done, so to speak.
So you're asking whether that's a worthwhile path.
Yeah.
Well,
in light of what we're just discussing.
Right. Well, I think a person has to be realistic that you have to live and eat, and you have to be happy. And there are things that you know, that King Solomon is exposing. But I don't think that your typical person or most people are really capable or desirous of living that way. He had such great wisdom, and he wanted to really take it to the end. So he was motivated to really see where all this turns out. And he sees that, yeah, listen, there are certain things that he even said himself, that God placed he placed immortality in man's heart in order that man should be motivated to do things. It was necessary. If you take a look, and I think, you know, Genesis refers to that too, that there was a, you know, once Adam was punished, and now he was punished with death, so now God was worried that he was going to eat from the tree of life and live forever. Meaning, if you just understand that statement, that means that once death came into the picture, now man sought after immortality. He needed to have it. He wanted to deny that. And Ibn Ezra says that Adam was a great intellect. Nonetheless, the psychological need of permanence on earth is needed. It is needed. It's a rare person that could see through all this, like King Solomon. So I don't believe we are to live that way, to tell you the truth. He's exposing it for the truisms that are there, and it's a good thing to study. But I think a typical person living a Torah life, he has to have the goals. He has to set up because he needs to eat. He needs to, and God's blessing that we are, the day of death is hidden, and that we have a sense of immortality in us is necessary for us to move on. So that is what those books say in terms of setting goals and going after them. So it is important for a person to feel positive and to be here. A person gets older and he starts looking back on his life. Now he's going to have a different state of mind. His sense of accomplishment and so on will be loosened up because he's made. He has what to live on, or he has children, or he's just not in that state anymore. And now he's even more perfected. So the things that he had to deny youth, he does not have to deny when he gets older. And now he starts embracing. He starts looking forward. What's going to happen next? But we're not at that state. And the healthy attitude is, like the books say, you do have to live. If a person starves himself and dies, God holds that person accountable. And like you said, the person should serve God in happiness. He should enjoy getting together and learning and to see the enjoyments and studying and the work and a certain sense of accomplishment. Those are all necessary. God would not have imbued man with the sense for, and the need for accomplishment unless it was needed in some measure. So we're riding two rails here. We're studying King Solomon, understanding the brutal honesty that he is describing for us, and we also have to be honest with ourselves that what is necessary at our stage in life, and with the Torah's philosophy, what we should be doing, and that we recognize that God did allow us to have a certain sense of a certain amount of duration. The rabbis say that, when you're older, hit your 90s, when you reflect, it's a different state. So I know it throws a little monkey wrench into it when you read something like Solomon like this, but it's for the, we're trying to really understand the truth here. And what is man made of? Okay. I mean, it's important too at the same time. We don't deny death. But it's not something that we are, you can't function that way on a daily basis. I don't think God made a person in a way where he loves a bright sunny day and beautiful trees and all, and that's a mistake. You can't say that. All right, so let's pick up from, we got into chapter 2, so now we're up to chapter 2, verse 3. That's where he's going to now start experimenting more with the real physical, and we'll see what he says. So we'll go next week from chapter 2, verse 3. You read through. Read through. Let's see. I guess you can read through that whole chapter. I'm not sure if it ends on the... it does go for a little bit. Read, I'd say, the first 10, 15 verses. But, of course, we'll start with the verse 3. And we'll see what his next experiment was. Where he starts talking about vineyards and palaces and gardens and trees and gold and silver. What exactly was he doing here? And then he examined himself. So, again, he is both the subject and the observer. He's the scientist and the laboratory rat at the same time. All right. And Rivka is writing on screen that we have quite to contemplate all that we have, and the world is too hectic. Yeah, so we have to go in bite-sized pieces. Take you know, each day and take, you know, try to continue our learning. And we don't have to get caught up all with things that are hectic. I think the notion that, you know, something is hectic or a person had a busy day, this and that, a person has to be able to focus on what's really important. And I think that's something which the rabbis did, and the people who lived properly did, that they were able to really enjoy their life because they lived based on wisdom, and that was really where they were looking for the happiness. You see here, so far, King Solomon is exploring the... he doesn't talk about studying Torah yet, does he? I mean, it's a very important thing. He's not anywhere rejecting the life of studying Torah. He's exploring and uncovering different attitudes that people have that are where they assume they're going to be happy, like building things, and like what he's going to do next week. And before him, we spoke about, oh, we're going to have certain actions. The actions that I do in life, that's going to afford me some happiness. Right? But that, no. That's crooked. Or just looking at events. I'm going to have a son, but at the end he's going to be this, he's going to be that. It doesn't say anywhere. That, or when he talks about riches, if I use my intelligence and I apply it to riches, I'll say, well, it's going to, is the problem of my riches being stolen, or I invest in something bad? It does not say anywhere that the pursuit of wisdom was something that was painful. Just keep that in mind. And that's really what the focus is of a person who's really having an enjoyable life. He's not reflecting on the self, but Rabbi Chait mentioned this. That's really, I mean, you talk about Einstein. There was a special the other night I was watching about Einstein and how he, one person said the sentiment which really struck me. He said he would, for 8 years, he was working on this theory of relativity. And he would spend, long hours into the night. So when he said that, it really shows you, it depicts an image of a person who's really enjoying what he's doing. Because how can you spend so many hours into the night searching for something unless it's affording you great enjoyment? And you don't see over here that King Solomon is saying that anywhere. Yeah, knowledge in terms of applying it to certain physical things, or certain realizations, that was depressing, right? Or knowledge that he used, he was able to see past the state of just being a person that drinks all day, But he didn't say that the pursuit of wisdom was something which was painful anywhere, right? So it's important that you recognize that. Because that he cannot say. Because that is how a person is enjoying it. He's not reflecting on the self. He's not looking for the state of accomplishment. He's not looking for the next action or the next award dinner where he's a centerpiece. You understand?
Yes.
There's a difference when you're the focus or when there's something out there that you're absorbed in that really catches your mind and it captivates you. Because there's only so much energy you could put into the self. You're a static being. You know yourself. I mean, then you can look into yourself in terms of wanting to straighten out certain character traits that are not good. But there's no great, you know, unless you're looking at the body, but that's not you anymore. That's the human body to see God's wisdom. So a person really gets to the bottom of the hole very quick when the self is the focus. What's so deep about the self? It's not yielding such great inquiry. It's not yielding him such, you know, interesting questions over here. So that's why when these people that King Solomon was talking about were their pursuits were self-centered. Right? All right. It's interesting also, I mean, in 1:16 he says, "Behold, I have become great and I have increased in wisdom more than all those before me." There you can say he's just telling the reader that so they should really respect his words. But the knowledge that he applied there in 17, again, as Ibn Ezra said, that, one second, yeah, it was knowledge of his son, or his wealth, or the day of death, it was reflected on the self. There's going to be, when a person is looking for the sense of satisfaction in the self, you see that that's a problem, that hits a dead end. And when he says, when happiness, what does it do for me? I mean, what's the accomplishment? See, that's the problem. If that's what you're looking for, if you're looking for accomplishment in that area, so then you have a problem. Because that won't satisfy you. But if you're looking for knowledge, and you see something out there, and that's, hey, that's an interesting idea, that could satisfy you. And then you look for a little bit more. So then the self is really passive. And your focus is not now gauging what did this do for me right now, but it's purely because you were curious about just getting an answer to a question. Why does this thing work that way? The self was no longer the picture. And that's really where the happiness will come from. Okay. So let's, we'll keep that in mind, and we'll pick up, unless there's any questions or comments you want to make now. So I still have some more time here.
I think we're good here.
Okay. All right, so we'll wrap it up. We'll pick up chapter 2, verse 3 next week, 11:15.
Okay, Rabbi, thanks very much.
Okay, have a great week, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, you too.
Okay, thanks so much.
Bye.